Would the marshal call the court to order, please?
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Loken, Judge Johnson, Judge Bjorkman, the Honorable Michelle A. Loken presiding.
Good morning and thank you to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. It's November 19th, 2020. This session of the Court of Appeals is being conducted on the Zoom format online. I don't know if the attorneys who are before us in this case have appeared in this forum before. The rules are the same. Each attorney will have 15 minutes for argument. Appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. You'll notice on the screen that we have displayed a timekeeping mechanism as we can for today's purposes. Please be mindful of the time on the clock. Also, please watch the judges in case they are trying to signal you that they want to interrupt with a question. And each of you should be sure to state your name for the record immediately beginning your argument. And we are at this point ready to hear from counsel in the first case, State versus Brown Eagle.
Good morning, Your Honor. Thank you, and may it please the court. My name is Amy Lawler. I'm an assistant state public defender, and I represent the appellant, Gerald Brown Eagle. This is a case, the latest in 5 years of litigation involving the DOC's failure to follow statutory regulations and this court's dictates in Marlowe and the Supreme Court's dictates in Ford. Minnesota has a determinant sentencing scheme in which people committed to the Department of Corrections serve 2/3 of their sentence in prison. After that, the subsequent 1/3 supervised release term and any conditional release term are served in the community to assist in the supervisee's reintegration. To that end, the DOC is obligated to set the terms and conditions of release. It's obligated to impose only workable conditions of release, and it is obligated to supervise these people in the community, as was held by the appellate courts in Marlowe and in Ford.
Ms. Lawler, what is the DOC failing to do in this case?
The DOC is once again acting as a mere scrivener, as described in Ford, in deferring to a county's preference not to accept supervision or assign a supervised release agent to investigate a potential placement or to accept supervision in the community.
Is your client currently eligible for release?
Right now, no. He's been reincarcerated and he is due to be released on December 29th.
And why is he reincarcerated?
Due to a violation that he committed.
Has he had more than one violation?
Yes.
How many has he had?
Well, since his sentence expired in 2017, I believe he has had two. He had several during the last 3/3 of his sentence as well.
And is it fair to say that the record suggests the reason we are not able to find housing for your client is because he fails to remain in compliance with his conditions of release?
No, it is not fair to say that. And indeed, that is not the issue here. That the issue is that Mr. Brown Eagle did find housing in Hennepin County, including in a sober house, which would have been a good placement for him, in a community where he has friends, family, and support. Hennepin County—
But Ms. Lawler, I mean, isn't it true that the county of commitment is also an appropriate placement?
It can be.
Isn't that what he's had for since his release in early 2017?
Well, there's two issues there. One is that the DOC should be making that decision and not deferring to counties about whether or not they will agree to supervise. And two, the fact that he has been repeatedly released to a county where he lacks social support and then has failed there, I think further indicates that his preference to return to his community and his caseworker's preference to submit a plan where they believe he can be successful in Hennepin County among his friends, family, and social supports indicates that that would be the best place for him. But the DOC is refusing to assign a supervised release agent in Hennepin to even investigate a placement. The DOC is acting just as it did in Ford and acting as a mere scrivener and allowing a county to simply say, I will not assign a supervised release agent to even investigate. This is exactly the conduct that the DOC engaged in Ford. It was prohibited in Ford. And yet 2 weeks after the Supreme Court issued its Ford decision, the DOC is again indicating in writing that it doesn't intervene in release placement decisions, despite the fact that it's not only obligated to intervene, but obligated to set those conditions of release. And that's the fundamental issue here, is that the DOC has obligations under the law that it's not meeting. And this is not a situation.
Ms. Lawler, before you go further down there, I mean, isn't there a fundamental first question about whether an exception to mootness applies? Because clearly, at the time this habeas petition came forward for decision before the district court, your client was in fact released into the community again, correct?
Correct.
So why? How is this case ripe for our consideration? Or why did the district court err in finding the issue moot?
I think it's not moot for the same issue that, for the same reason that Ford was not moot. And again, Ford was remaining in the community at the time that the Supreme Court issued its decision and found that the case was not moot, which is that it's not moot because we need this court's guidance and direction on what the DOC is obligated to do during this term of supervision, including whether or not it is obligated to fulfill its obligation to set the conditions of release, including the location of release. Mr. Brown Eagle is on conditional release for the rest of his life. It's a lifetime conditional release term. And so for the rest of his life, there's going to be a question whether or not the DOC can simply defer to Hennepin County's preference that he never return there, or whether the DOC needs to make its own independent assessment as to whether or not he should be assigned a release agent there and whether or not the placement that he is proposing is suitable.
When you say he should be assigned a release agent there, do you mean a supervised release agent that's under the supervision of the DOC or under the supervision of the local corrections department?
It could be either one. And that was actually the issue in Ford, was that because Hennepin County Community Corrections refused to assign an agent, ultimately the DOC assigned one of its own to supervise Ford in Hennepin County. And the DOC has that choice. It can choose to continue making the funding payments under the CCA to Hennepin County, or it can choose not to. It could choose to assign an agent from the CCA County, or it could choose to assign one of its own. We're not asking this court to dictate the details of how an agent should be assigned, but we are asking the court to enforce the law and enforce the requirement that the DOC is required to do those things. That supervision is not permissive, and that we do not operate under an indeterminate sentencing scheme in which parole is permissive. We operate under a scheme in which community supervision is obligatory, and under Marlowe and Ford, the DOC is the one that's obligated to carry it out. And if they choose to subcontract that essentially to CCA counties, they can do so within the confines of the law, but they can't simply ignore the law and say, Hennepin doesn't want to supervise this person, so we'll keep him in prison for a few months past his release date, and then release him to a plan that we know isn't a good one, that we know is in a place where he doesn't have friends, family, or community support, and where he hasn't had any ability to succeed. Whether or not that's lawful is a question before this court. And I think that after Marlowe and after Ford, more clear language from this court and perhaps a more stringent directive is necessary to indicate whether or not the DOC actually has those obligations that the Supreme Court laid out in Ford, or whether it doesn't. But if it does, and the statutes and the administrative rules and the DOC's own policies indicate that they do, then the DOC has acted unlawfully here. It's also acted in violation of Brown Eagle's constitutional rights. Here in particular, there was a pretty egregious procedural due process violation and failing to give him the hearing that he was entitled to when he was incarcerated past the date that he was able to be released when he completed treatment and was not released to the placement that his caseworker believed was suitable and submitted. There's also a substantive due process violation in that he was not released from prison after he'd completed his term of incarceration as dictated by the administrative hearing officer, but was nonetheless incarcerated for 4 months past that date, with Hennepin County simply indicating that they would not assign a supervised release agent, would not investigate placements, and giving reasons that the DOC neither investigated nor verified.
Ms. Lawler, with respect to Marlowe, it seems like, are you asking us to expand Marlowe? Because if I look at Marlowe, in the analysis, we said the issue in this case is whether DOC has an obligation to restructure when no suitable residence exists in his county of commitment, but suitable residences are available in a neighboring county. I mean, because the Bemidji ISR house is in his county of commitment, I mean, if the DOC chose to place him there, haven't they satisfied their obligation under Marlowe?
I think there's two issues there. One is he was held past his release date by an additional 4 months. So even if he would even if you were to conclude that that placement did satisfy its obligations, it didn't do so in a timely manner due to that delay.
I have a question about that later on, but go ahead. But let's say apart from that.
Apart from that, no, we're not asking you to expand Marlow. I think Ford already did that. And so what we're asking you to do is apply both Marlow and Ford in this context. Because Ford was very clear that the violation here was not one of a particular placement or a particular agent, but rather the DOC's adopted practice of acting as mere scriveners in essentially delegating the authority that it is obligated to carry out. It's obligated to decide where someone will be supervised and what those terms and conditions of release will be.
So how did Ford expand Marlow? What does Ford require that Marlow did not require?
Ford specifically said that the mere scrivening of release planning efforts does not satisfy the department's obligations under
Marlow. Okay, but that phrase isn't very helpful because that tells us what they can't do, but it's just really just a characterization. I mean, it's not, I mean, what must the department do for a person? Well, I mean, for persons, let me go back to my question. What did Ford say that the department must do that Marlow did not say?
Ford said that the DOC had to supervise Ford in Hennepin County during the duration of his conditional release term. That was the ultimate holding. And the DOC did so. It assigned its own supervised release agents, DOC agents, and it supervised Ford until he expired in the community in Hennepin County. And we're essentially asking for that same result here, that if a person comes forward with a suitable placement in a CCA county, and he and his caseworker have decided that it's the best placement for him, that the DOC cannot simply say, we won't supervise you there because Hennepin doesn't want you. And this could be any county, but in practice, it is most often in Hennepin and Ramsey counties, the counties with the most available services, and the counties where many of our clients have extensive friends, families, and social supports. And so this is something that is coming up repeatedly. It's come up repeatedly in the past 5 years, and I think it's going to continue to occur, which is that a person comes forward and said, I grew up in Hennepin County. Everybody I know and love is there. I want to go there. Can the DOC say, no, Hennepin doesn't want you? I think Ford says, no, it can't do that. As long as your placement is suitable, the DOC and you and your caseworker agree that it's suitable and you submit the plan, the DOC must supervise you. They must make arrangements to supervise you in some way. It can be that they
also require- let me stop you there. So I want to make sure I understand how this will work, given what you've just described. So an inmate is ready for conditional release. He wants to go, let's say, to Hennepin County. His caseworker supports that. So you have some evidence to present showing that somebody at the DOC thinks this is a good release plan, but the DOC says no because Hennepin County says no. You want to be able to go to the district court, have the district court develop an evidentiary or a factual record, and ultimately then the district court will make the call regarding whether or not the person can be on conditional release in Hennepin County. Because ultimately then the district court would order the DOC to make the placement in Hennepin. Is that how this would work?
Well, ideally, we wouldn't need the district court. Ideally, the DOC would just follow this court's directives and there would be no district court involvement. The DOC, the hearings and release unit, which is required under 2940.1300, they would make that decision. We would only get to the district court by a habeas petition or to the appellate court.
Right. But this is what I'm trying to understand. The hearings and release unit is part of the DOC.
Yes.
So they say place in Hennepin County. The DOC says, no, we're not going to. Are you looking for a rule of law that says anytime the hearings and release unit says place in a county, the DOC has to follow the hearings and release unit?
Well, I think that already exists. The hearings and release unit is the one that sets the conditions of release. I don't think there's a distinction between the hearings and release component of the DOC. Those are fairly interchangeable.
But what I'm not understanding is why isn't the placement happening? If the hearings and release unit is part of the DOC, the hearings and release unit recommends placement in Hennepin. Hennepin says no. But that technically doesn't prohibit the placement because the DOC can assign its own agent and make it happen. Why isn't it happening? I mean, at some point there is a conflict that requires judicial intervention. And it seems to me that the conflict is between the hearings and release unit and the DOC itself. To the extent the DOC is able to effectuate this placement, even if Hennepin says, no, they won't supervise.
Well, in this case, And in the other cases that we brought, it's not HRU saying that they want the placement there, it's the case manager. And so the case manager isn't a part of the hearings and release unit. The case manager works in the prison. The case manager is the one under the administrative rules and the policies that creates the proposed
plan. So the conflict is between the case manager and the DOC, bigger DOC.
Yes, and even more
so fundamental. Somebody has to decide who's right about the place manager. The case manager says, I think this placement is fine. He or she will do well there. DOC says, we don't agree. We're not going to implement that. Then there is a conflict, and then the court steps in and decides whether or not that placement is appropriate.
Well, we haven't actually gotten to the point where the DOC has been making that call. What we've had so far is the DOC saying they're deferring to the county's decision that it's not an appropriate placement. And that's what you
but
see.
Now the DOC has been told it can't do that, correct?
They have, but they're still doing it. This all occurred weeks after the Ford decision. Just within 2 weeks after the Ford decision being issued, the DOC's hearing officers are sending emails saying HRU does not intervene in placement decisions. This is an egregious violation of this court's directives in Marlowe and the Supreme Court's
I'm just trying to understand where we get to with your argument. It seems to be your argument is anytime a case manager says place the individual in this county, the DOC has to do it.
I wouldn't go that far, but I would say that the hearings and release unit actually has to follow the policies, which is to approve that placement unless there is a reason as laid out in policy not to. And that reason cannot be deference to a CCA county.
Okay. And the reason here was deference to the county.
Yes.
Understood.
Judge Larkin, if before
of course.
We're done, I have maybe one or two more questions.
Oh, please.
So Ms. Lawler, I believe it was February or March of 19 when he was revoked. The hearing officer said 365 days or less shall do treatment. I think he completed treatment in late July of 2019. So does the obligation that you're talking about kick in immediately then, or is it not until the 365th day? And I guess I'm interested in your source of law. And I guess I would like you to keep in mind also our court's opinion in Lino, which I read to say that the date is simply a projected date and the commissioner has broad discretion and is not necessarily bound by that, depends on other circumstances and so on. So, in other words, you and your client filed the habeas petition before the 365th day. I'm wondering, I think it's your obligation then to show that there was an unlawful detention as of that time, as opposed to perhaps a later time. Anyway, could you address that general issue? And I guess, and to help us out, I guess, as much as possible, identify the sources of law that guide us in analyzing that issue.
Of course. And so you're correct that the DOC has to set a revocation term. And in this case, they set a revocation term of 365 days or less with a CD treatment directive. The source for the fact that he was eligible to be released early comes in the addendum of the email attachments that were attached to the habeas petition filed in the district court. In the emails in early September, for example, September 10th of 2019, Michelle Wilson says that he can be added, Brown Eagle can be added to the hearing calendar. Angela Halseth says that they already have a rejection from Hennepin County and they can go ahead to schedule the hearing on September 23rd. These are addendums at A6 and A8 to the original habeas filing. Again, on page A10, where hearing officer Tara Rathman on September 25th says his release is contingent upon an agent approved plan and goes on to say HRU does not intervene with placement issues. So the source here is not a particular rule or statute that says with an or less disposition and a CD treatment directive, the release comes on X date. It's that was what the original hearing officer dictated in the revocation, and that's how it was interpreted by subsequent hearing officers and by the case manager that Mr. Brown Eagle was eligible to be released after he completed treatment on July 30th. And I think your second question about Lano and specifically about the use of the review hearing process here, it's slightly different because Mr. Ford didn't have any review hearings. There was no procedural due process to extend any particular date. But I do think that fundamentally the issue here was addressed in Ford, not specific to the context of a review hearing, but Ford generally dictated that once that revocation term has been served, that obligation to supervise takes over. And so that's true regardless of whether a review hearing was held or not. And under Ford, I believe that the DOC had the obligation to supervise Brown Eagle after he became eligible for release and his caseworker submitted an appropriate plan and it failed to do so.
But, I mean, let's say, assuming for the moment, that even if we accept your argument about the DOC's obligation to supervise, assign an agent, and so on, why wouldn't we say that that obligation does not kick in until the 365th day at the earliest, or later if the commissioner in his discretion decides to extend it? But why would we choose a date that's within the 365th day or before it?
Well, because the revocation was for 365 days or less. And so that or less has been read by the agency itself to mean that he was eligible for release after that date, but it was contingent upon an agent approved plan and Hennepin County wouldn't agree to assign an agent. If there is a further factual dispute about what that or less meant, I think that it would have been appropriate or would be appropriate to remand for additional fact finding. But I don't think that based on the record before us, there's any indication that anyone at the DOC had interpreted that to mean that he had to sit for that full 365 days. The DOC's own actions indicated that he began release planning as soon as he finished treatment. So I think that the facts as understood by both parties were that he was eligible for release. And if there's further after July 30th, and if there's further dispute about that, I think that that would be a factual determination that would have to be made by a fact finder.
One more question, if I may, Judge Larkin.
Of course.
Ms. Lawler, wait a minute, would you agree, would you concede that at some point, if an offender has multiple violations, that it may make their housing situation more difficult, and at some point that might modify or it affects the scope of the commissioner's duty to supervise and approve a placement and so on. I mean, at some point the offenders might find themselves in a difficult position because of their own actions, right?
Of course. And Mr. Brown Eagle, like Ford himself, came before this court with multiple violations of a supervised release. And with the DOC making the same arguments that this person is very difficult to place. And so that essentially justifies the prolonged incarceration term. But the law doesn't allow that. The law still requires the DOC to supervise under our determinate sentencing scheme. And so if the DOC were to make a determination that someone had committed egregious violations that warranted a much longer period of incarceration, it would have to revoke for that period of time. It can't simply revoke for a shorter period of time under our statutory scheme when there's an obligatory supervision term and say, you know what, that time is up, but he's very difficult to supervise. We're not going to let him out. We don't have a discretionary parole system. And so under the law, even the most difficult of my clients deserve the right to be supervised in the community after they've served their terms of revocation.
So would the commissioner have discretion, say with a very difficult person who repeatedly violates terms, would the commissioner have discretion to say, I'm tired of this in and out, and this person needs a lot more correction, and so I'm going to revoke for 5 years and hope that during that time in prison with programming, he changes his behavior. And then we'll see, because the Bemidji ISR house is, you know, justifiably tired of dealing with his violating behavior. I mean, would that be within the discretion of the commissioner in some cases?
And in fact, the commissioner has exercised that authority. We've had clients who have been revoked for 5 years or more. And the DOC's policies do kind of lay out what findings have to be made in a situation where the revocation is for longer than 6 months and there's no new criminal conviction. And so the hearing officer would have to make certain findings, but absolutely it's within their authority and they do that somewhat regularly. They do that every week. And so I think that's our fundamental problem is that they given that authority, given the authority to revoke for as long as they want to, essentially under the rules, once that revocation term is up, they don't get to then extend it again. They have to set the term of the revocation, the term of the incarceration, and then the statutory supervisory obligation kicks in, and that's laid out under Ford exactly what that means, including setting the terms and conditions of release.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Lawler. We're now ready for arguments on behalf of the state. Counsel, would you identify yourself for the record before you begin your argument?
Yes, good morning, Your Honor. My name is Steve Forrest. I'm an Assistant Attorney General here on behalf of the Minnesota Department of Corrections. May it please court. At the outset, I'd just like to start by stating that this court has now heard a lot of information that's outside of the record in this case. That's information specifically pertinent to the records in Marlowe and Ford, and a lot of argument based on the records in those cases. This case, however, must be analyzed based on its own record. And this case is not complicated. Gerald Brown-Eagle filed a habeas petition that sought only one form of relief, his immediate release from prison. When he was released from prison, the district court no longer could give him the relief he was seeking, and his case became moot. And we now have Supreme Court precedent in Ford on when a habeas petitioner's claim becomes moot by virtue of his release. This is the precedent that the district court properly applied in finding Brown-Eagle's case was moot, and this is the precedent this court should apply in this its review. Ford held that a habeas petitioner's claim is not moot by virtue of his release if his return to prison is imminent and almost inevitable, using the language of the court. The district court here considered that precedent and specifically gave Mr. Brown-Eagle an opportunity to supplement the record as he chose fit. This afforded Brown-Eagle an opportunity to demonstrate that his release met this Ford standard. And despite having this opportunity, Brown-Eagle placed no evidence in the record demonstrating his release to the Bemidji House was temporary. And this is not a case where we have an affidavit from Mr. Brown-Eagle providing evidence that his return to prison was imminent and almost inevitable, or raising a fact question about whether this Ford standard was met. He presented no evidence, made no offer of proof, and did not even argue to the district court that he should have an evidentiary hearing on that limited basis. Instead of this—
Mr. Forrest, how many times had Mr. Brown-Eagle been in that particular placement in Bemidji?
Four times. My count by the record.
Yeah, and doesn't the fact that he has been unsuccessful there all four times suggest that in fact it is just a temporary placement again back at that facility?
No, Your Honor, because the record demonstrates that every time that he was revoked was due to his own behavior. So there's nothing in the record that suggests that it would be temporary beyond when we got to the point that his own inappropriate and unlawful behavior and the violations of his conditions of release resulted in his revocation. So,
Mr. Forrest, doesn't the fact that he's been unsuccessful, and I know what he violated, and that's been demonstrated by the record, but the fact that for whatever reason, that placement isn't providing the community support to facilitate his success on conditional release, isn't that something from which we can infer that sending him back there is a temporary band-aid and not going to be productive and suggestive that he will be successful in the community?
Well, I would say two things. You know, one, you know, certainly I would think it would be something that in the future, his agent and his case manager should be considering the fact that he is continuing to have these problems that are, you know, obviously his responsibility. But more importantly, as it's relevant to this court's decision and analysis, he does not get to manufacture the temporariness of his own housing. And he's manufacturing that by his own actions. And so as it's relevant to this court's analysis, particularly on the mootness issue, on the issue that we're asking this court to apply the precedent of Ford on whether or not this housing was, his revocation was imminent and almost inevitable. Certainly this court would have to find that it's imminent and almost inevitable under the Ford standard that he's prone to breaking the law and he's just going to break the law again. And the DOC doesn't believe that's imminent and almost inevitable. The DOC earnestly believes that Mr. Brown-Eagle can turn this pattern around, start behaving like everybody else and stay out of prison, and certainly has no interest in keeping him in prison like any other offender any longer than he has to be.
Counsel, I just want to again understand where this all ends up. So we have a situation where he keeps getting released to Bemidji. He doesn't want to be there. He keeps violating. If this court were to say, or to rule the way he wants and say, you've got to put him in Hennepin where he wants to be, are we essentially encouraging people to violate condition of release? Because then they can show, well, see, I can't be in Bemidji because I keep violating, which shows that Bemidji is not a good place for me. you've got to put me in Hennepin because there I will behave. I mean, are we just encouraging bad behavior?
Well, I think that's a very
or a longer revocation, because what I'm hearing from his lawyer is, well, if you don't think he can be released anywhere, you know, revoke him for 5 years. Is that the end game here?
Oh, certainly. Well, I think that's a very good point. I would add to that, however, that the DOC ultimately has remedies as outlined in Ford and based on the record of that Ford as to what to do when it disagrees with a decision by Hennepin County. But ultimately, it doesn't have authority over Hennepin County. It can't force Hennepin County to supervise. And here, what happened is not a situation where we had, like in Marlow or Ford, where there was an agent simply mistake who thought they couldn't supervise. We have a situation where Hennepin County lawfully in considering its statutory requirement, lawfully thought that or indicated after investigating that the housing that was available to him, at least on the most recent occasion, had a high concentration of sex offenders. In fact, must have done some investigation because it provided the numbers related to that level of in concentration of sex offenders. And Hennepin County is required to look at that by statute. They're required by statute to consider and mitigate the concentration of sex offenders to the greatest extent feasible under the law. And so there's no evidence in the record, despite Mr. Brown-Eagle having the opportunity to supplement the record if he thought Hennepin County was wrong. Obviously, Hennepin County is not a party to this case and not here to defend itself as to whether or not it was wrong, but certainly Mr. Brown-Eagle had an opportunity to say, I think that characterization was wrong, and here's a declaration to that effect, but we don't have that. After given the opportunity by the district court to supplement the record, all Brown-Eagle did was say, I was revoked like Ford through no fault of my own. And the district court was understandably unpersuaded by that because the record demonstrably showed that that was not true, that when he was revoked, it was not like Ford's circumstances. He was revoked due to his own conduct.
Would you agree with Ms. Lawler that Ford expanded on the relief in Marlow, expanded on the obligations of the commissioner?
No, Your Honor. I think that as most relevant to this case, Ford came in three parts. The part that's most relevant to the court's analysis here is related to mootness. It set the standard.
But let's assume that we go past mootness and we get to the merits. So on the merits, which is part three of Ford, did the Supreme Court there expand upon our opinion in Marlow?
No, it didn't. And in fact, it's the third part of that Ford decision was limited to the facts of the case and based on the record of that case. And that seemed to be very clear from the Ford opinion. There was an extensive record. There was an evidentiary hearing. And in looking at the record that we have here, it's fundamentally different from Ford in a lot of very important ways. If we did get to the merits, for instance, Ford was revoked solely because he lacked housing, and Brown-Eagle was never revoked solely for that basis. Ford had a suitable and available residence to him, and he was unable to live there. Oh, sorry, forgive me.
Ford did have one violation, I believe, while he was on supervised release. He was released, had a violation, went back in, completed his term of his sentence, right?
It is true that if you go back and you were to go through the whole history of Ford and go back into the district court record, that you would find that he was revoked due to his own conduct. But that's not what was relevant to the court's decision on the merits in Ford. What was relevant to the court's decision on the merits there was the fact that it was just related to his housing and that he didn't have suitable and approved housing. Or that he did, excuse me, but he wasn't able to have an agent approve him. And that's where this is distinguishable here if the court were to get to the merits.
Could I ask you, Mr. Forrest, to address the question I asked Ms. Lawler toward the end about the timing? In other words, the HRU officer said 365 or less, which is kind of an ambiguous statement. He completed treatment approximately midway during that period, maybe after 4 months. So when does the whatever duty the commissioner has with respect to the terms and conditions of conditional release and placement approving housing, when does that kick in?
And thank you, Judge Johnson. And I think that you actually hit it right on the head in your analysis of the Lino case. And that in the context of that, it's worth noting that there's a difference between a supervised release date that an offender gets as part of his determinant sentencing scheme, not at issue here, and a projected release date that he receives after he's revoked for violating his conditions of release. And there, what's different is that a new term of incarceration is imposed, and it's based upon new circumstances that jeopardize the offender's public safety and his ability to be released. And so the former is set by the sentencing court, and the latter is imposed after the process of a revocation hearing, like was held here, and the full panoply of rights afforded to Mr. Brown Eagle when he had that Morrissey hearing back in March of 2019, and he in fact admitted to the violation and it was set. So there is a big distinction there. And of course, there is no right as set forth by the court in Lino in having, there's no liberty interest, I should say, in your projected release date. It's is able to be extended. This court has held that that is lawful. It is also held that the review hearing process that we didn't even get to here. I mean, it's worth noting again that Brown Eagle never even made it to his projected release date. He had a term of imprisonment, and then he never made it to the end of that term of imprisonment before he was released. So the question would be, you know, what more process does Mr. Brown Eagle believe is due? The due process claims simply don't make sense, because he had all the process afforded with his Morrissey hearing. He admitted he got this term of imprisonment and he was released before it ended.
The Marlow opinion, I believe, is based in significant part on a DOC policy. Am I correct in understanding that policy was not an administrative rule adopted pursuant to notice and comment, but rather a lesser form of agency law? Is that true?
It is based on a DOC policy and not
203.010.
I should add that 0.018 is the policy that I think is relevant now, the policy that was has changed since this court's decision in Marlow.
That's my question, is I was going to ask about whether the policy has changed and in what ways, and was it an extensive revision or just minor modifications, or I don't know, can you address that generally?
Well, sure. I don't think it's relevant here that the policy is that any changes are outcome determinative in the case. What the policy does suggest is that when an offender proposes an agent that is to be investigated, if it's suitable and approved, then an agent is assigned once it's determined to be suitable and approved. And so I think we're focusing on process here over substance, because certainly somebody did an investigation at Hennepin County here, determined that the concentration of sex offenders was too high. And so the question is, you know, what would an agent have done to the extent that one was assigned here? If it was otherwise a lawful decision on the part of Hennepin County to refuse to supervise him, because the placement was not suitable and available, simply because, like the one in Ramsey, it was close to a school, or the most recent one, the concentration of sex offenders.
So just to be clear, you're not arguing that a change in the policy alters the precedential effect of Marlow and Ford.
I think it's worth considering if the court got to the merits. However, you know, Marlow holds, Marlow's facts are distinguished.
I'm talking about the merits now, but I didn't see that argument necessarily, but I just want to make sure that when we read Marlow and Ford, we can read them as having their full precedential value despite any modifications to underlying DOC policies.
That's correct. And the DOC is not contending that it's not following either of those. The DOC believes it is following Ford and Marlow and believes those are precedent that this court should apply, and that they're on the merits, there was no Marlow violation here. That's the DOC's position. I have very little time left. You know, I just want to emphasize what I did at the beginning, that this is not a complicated case. You know, we have a limited and narrow issue before this court. And we have clear precedent right on point. The issue before this court is mootness, and Ford sets a standard, and the district court applied that standard. So the DOC would ask this court to apply that standard as well, and to affirm the district court's decision that this case is moot. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Lawler, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. There are two main points that I'd like to cover first. One is the issue of concentration and deference, and the other is the DOC's obligations under the Community Corrections Act. I'd specifically like to point to the DOC policy 203.018, process F3B, which is discussed at page 12 in our brief. And that is where it describes how if a county says that it doesn't want to supervise someone or assign an agent based on concentration, there are certain things that the county has to do. And here, the county did not do them. The county didn't explain what the concentration was. It didn't explain the basis for determining that concentration. And the reason that this is important is that the reasons Hennepin County gave in refusing to assign an agent were the exact same ones that we were seeing from Hennepin and Ramsey County in the Ford case, that there was a lack of historical ties and that there was an over-concentration of level three sex offenders. And they would simply say these things. And the DOC then wouldn't do anything with that assertion. They wouldn't investigate it. They wouldn't push back. They didn't make their own independent determination that there was a concentration issue or that there was a lack of historical ties. And so that's the fundamental issue here, and the fundamental sameness with Ford as with Brown Eagle is that the DOC is disclaiming responsibility and allowing the CCA counties to say that we will not supervise, and the DOC simply accepts that. They act as mere scriveners. And this ties into the second issue, the DOC's obligations under the Community Corrections Act under 40106. Under that act, the DOC is allowed to make payments to the CCA counties and annually review them to make sure that they're in compliance with the rules. But this means that those counties have to follow the DOC's administrative rules and their policies, including inter-county transfers of persons on conditional release. And the reason then that 203.018, the DOC policy, matters is that there is a statutory obligation for the DOC to ensure that these CCA counties are following the requirements that the DOC has laid out to ensure that supervision takes place in the community as required under the law and under the administrative rules. That didn't happen here. The DOC has simply allowed Hennepin County and Ramsey County and the situations laid out in Ford and again in this case to say that we won't assign a supervised release agent. They'll simply give numbers or say there's too much concentration or there's no historical ties, even though the person can lay out extensive historical ties, even though there are no residency restrictions laying out where a predatory offender can live in Hennepin County. The DOC has simply accepted that. Under the Community Corrections Act, under Ford, it's not allowed to do that and say, well, I guess that means we have to keep the person in prison rather than releasing them. There are things that the DOC must do to ensure that that community supervision as required by statute takes place. That didn't happen.
If I could just interrupt, I mean, but here we have a situation where in fact your client was released. I mean, not maybe as quickly as he wanted to be, but he was released into the community. My question is this, did you argue in the district court that that placement in Bemidji was temporary?
Well, in the district court, when we filed, he was still in custody. And so that wasn't the issue. The temporary nature of the housing wasn't argued at all because he was still in custody and we were still seeking his release to Hennepin County. But in terms of the temporary nature of the housing, I had two issues. One is that the DOC policy 205.130 generally limits housing at a DOC house to 60 days. And so I think the record as laid out in the DOC's own rules and policies is that it is a temporary placement.
Yeah, but I think, yes, but again, the history was that your client had been there for longer than 60-day stints several times in between his violations.
And correct? Yes, and the DOC policy does allow extensions. And so that's true that it could extend beyond 60 days. But certainly there's nothing in the policies or the administrative rules that indicate that it is a permanent placement. It's designed to be temporary, and while extensions are allowed, it is still a temporary placement. But I think the other issue, the reason he was seeking release to Hennepin then, the reason he still asks this court's guidance in directing that the DOC be required to consider and make the decisions about where he will be released and not just defer to Hennepin is that all of his historical ties are in Hennepin. All of his community is there, his family is there, his opportunities for employment and residence are there. And so this isn't just a question of whether or not the DOC house was temporary, but that he and his caseworker followed the DOC's policies in determining that Hennepin, particularly a sober house in Hennepin, would be the best placement for him. And the DOC simply said, well, we can't do that because we don't interfere with release planning. We defer to Hennepin County. And that's the ultimate issue that we asked this court to reach today in reversing the district court.
Ms. Lawler, you lament the fact that, as you say, the local agents will say, they'll give reasons for denying the placement, such as the numbers, the concentration, lack of community ties, and so on. Are those decisions or are those reasons reviewable in any way? I mean, are you lamenting them because they're unreviewable and therefore, you know, they frustrate your client's ability to get that kind of placement, or are they things that could be inquired into in some judicial action, such as a habeas action or something else? And I asked this question with a little bit of trepidation, but I'm trying to understand your position about whether those decisions that are made by agents are reviewable in some way or not.
They are. And I think the first step, hopefully this will make you less trepid, is that the DOC's own quasi-judicial administrative hearing officers, the hearings and release unit, should be the first one reviewing those. The fact that they've refused to do though and essentially passed the buck to the Minnesota judiciary is a problem. They are the ones that are supposed to be making those decisions. They're not supposed to be able to say under the law that they will simply defer to the county. If the DOC's own quasi-judicial administrative hearing officers refuse to take up that issue, then yes, we'll end up where we've been for the past 5 years, filing a steady parade of cases as either writs of certiorari or writs of habeas corpus now that will reach the courts in an unending stream, because this hasn't stopped. It hasn't slowed down. And so we're asking the court to be more direct in what HRU's obligations are, what the DOC's obligations are under Ford and under Marlowe. So hopefully we can stop doing this and hopefully we can stop meeting at the Court of Appeals and at the Supreme Court on these issues.
Well, that was a useful answer to me. It addressed something I was raising before, which was, okay, who's supposed to hear the evidence and make the decision? So essentially what you're saying is it shouldn't be the district court in the first instance. Hearings and release unit should have some sort of administrative evidentiary hearing and come up with their recommendation. Then if your client disagrees with it, what happens from there?
Then I think there would be a right to appeal that under In re Hames. There would be a right for review either by writ of certiorari or writ of habeas corpus. But our hope would be that we would stop doing this with this.
You're trying to do is you're trying to avoid having to go to the district court to get your first evidentiary hearing. You want that to happen within the DOC system.
Yes. Right now, he got his evidentiary hearing on the first revocation. There hasn't been an evidentiary hearing since then. But even if there had been a review hearing, what we've seen under Ford is that in those hearings, the DOC's hearing officers have been acting as mere scriveners. They write down what happened, but they don't make their own findings and they don't make their own determinations. They need to start doing that under Marlowe.
Is there anything in the rules or policies that require them to make findings and write them down so they're available for review by a court?
Well, there's a requirement that they make the final decisions regarding the conditions of parole, supervised release, or work release, and that's under 2940.1300. There is also a DOC policy laying out how hearings work, the revocation hearing, and since the Ford litigation, they've added a policy on review hearings. And I think that those read in conjunction with Marlowe and Ford would be read as saying that, yes, they can't just write down what the parties say. They actually have to make a decision about whether or not a proposed placement is suitable, whether or not that person should be released to a particular place, because they are obligated under Marlowe and Ford to set the terms and conditions of an individual's release.
I believe Judge Johnson had a question. I'm sorry, Judge Johnson.
No, our questions are on the same topic. And I guess I had only one short follow-up, and that is, you said, Ms. Lawler, I think that under the law, the HRU, the hearing officer must make that decision. I just want to be clear about what law you're talking about. I think it's a DOC policy that you're referring to. Is that correct?
Well, I think it's also under, Marlo was the first one that laid it out and saying that the DOC must release and supervise. And I think it was citing in particular, not just DOC policy, although it is in the policy, but 24405 and 609.3455, they lay out that the DOC has to supervise. And then there are additional.
I'm sorry, my question may not have been clear or specific. I guess that I'm referring to, I think your statement that the hearing officer specifically, that person must make a determination, in conjunction with the placement. And I guess I'm wondering what law is it that requires, because I mean, the hearing officer is a department employee, reports up to the commissioner. It's essentially, seems to me, the hearing officer is simply the commissioner's delegee. And so I don't know why what law says the hearing officer, that particular person must make the decision rather than the commissioner or anybody in between them in the org chart. But
well, if I could briefly answer, it's, yeah, Minnesota Rule 2940.1300 subpart 2.
Could you repeat that, please?
2940.1300 subpart 2, the administrative rules. And that rule says that the DOC's executive officer of hearings and release shall make the final decision. So obviously it's not always the executive officer of hearings release. Sometimes that she delegates to the other hearings and release officers, but it says that the executive officer of hearings and release shall make the final decision regarding the conditions of parole, supervised release.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Seeing no other questions, that will conclude the hearing on the matter. Thank you.